Item 20.
So item 20, executive officer's report, which you have. There are a couple of things, as I mentioned to a couple of you during the briefings, that, of course, these documents tend to lag what we are doing by weeks sometimes, and things can be pretty dynamic around here. So I just want to mention a couple of other things for you that are not necessarily in the report. Some of you may or may not know we're going to be adding three new oil staff to the organization, and they will be going into a brand new unit that will have four oil staff along with a couple of groundwater staff, and that'll generate a brand new unit. We'll have a brand new senior. I don't know if John Robertson wants to comment on it, but John, it'll be under John, because John right now has a bunch of staff direct reports to them. So he's kind of loaded up and has been working a lot on the oil related work. So we really need that. And the announcement for the senior, I've been checking it this week. I don't know, John, if you know if it's out yet. I've been checking it. The first couple of days, I didn't see it on VPAWS or on the State Board's website.
So, John Robertson,
staff. You just turned it off.
I actually sent an email while we're sitting here because I checked VPAWS this morning and it's not up on VPAWS yet. That's the listing of all positions for the state. So, checking on it.
Good question, Mr. Chair. What's the oil program?
So this relates to active oil field regulation, and I was planning to talk about this a little bit more in a later item, the priorities item, but it's active oil field regulation, and you'll recognize it under more commonly used terms like SB4 associated with hydraulic fracturing, sump investigations for the disposal sumps and characterization of disposal sumps in oil fields, aquifer exemption applications, and the underground injection control program. These are all affiliated with Dogger. Dogger has historically been the primacy agency for them. The Water Board is becoming much more involved at the direction of the legislature.
Do we currently have discharge permits associated with oil operations?
We do not.
And why would
that be? We actually have two. One in the Arroyo Grande oil field, it is an MPDS permit. They reverse osmosis, they use a reverse osmosis treatment system and then discharge into the Pismo Creek currently. And then we have a waste discharge requirement for a very similar operation up in San Ardo operated by Chevron.
Right.
And those are the only two that have discharge permits. Many other oil fields are discharging their wastewater, and I don't mean that in the classical context of wastewater. It's oil field water that they're discharging, not domestic wastewater. Mm-hmm. Many of them do it under the Underground Injection Control Authority that is through US EPA and delegated to Dogger. And many of those permits are being reevaluated at this time as to their appropriateness for discharge. Some were authorized and are in clear conflict with the Federal Drinking Water Act. So the state is reevaluating those permits.
Well, that is exactly my understanding. So I'm glad to see that we're shifting forward into evaluating exactly how the industry is being regulated currently, because it is very likely that we're going to see, there is already attention and applications for permitting to begin exploring methods for the accessing the Monterey Shale deposit. And I don't know, in this climate, in the oil economic climate, that's actually as potentially coming up in the near future as it might have been a few years ago, but I think this is probably a good window to reposition. So I'm
right.
So that you'll be having four full-time staff, or
correct? So we literally
maybe excuse me. I mean, I'll let you answer that, but I would like to have this discussion framed more as part of our strategic plan, because we were going to go over staff allocation, resource priorities. Right. So I don't want us to get too much ahead of ourselves, but please go ahead and
So I'll just briefly answer and say, yes, we'll have four new positions. We actually have that amount of work right now and are scrambling to do that. We're getting relief from State Board. State Board's chipping in right now, but by the end of the calendar year, we hope to have all those positions filled.
Just two more items. We just this week, it's been a busy week, we met for 3 or 4 hours with Dogger and State Board staff and Dogger headquarters staff, working on reviewing the technical aspects of the very first aquifer exemption in the state that staff has been working on. So that's a fairly recent activity. And the last thing was I wanted, a couple times yesterday, things came up about like Taya working on the compost, and actually Taya has been part of the State Board's task force for a couple of years working on that. I wanted to just, I've said this before, I just want to remind you that your staff is extremely active in statewide issues, and they participate in all kinds of task work groups that you don't ever hear about. You know, an upcoming one, for example, is Lisa and Jennifer Epp are going to be working with the TMDL program as they re-engineer the data system planner tracker to accommodate tracking the implementation of TMDLs, which is something we've been trying to do for about 10 years, which will be really a great benefit to not only the TMDL program, but others. So they'll be traveling, you know, around, going to different meetings around the state. So I just wanted to let you know that we are very, very much engaged in helping to shape the statewide future of programs with the Water Board.
And in another example is Monday, Lisa McCann is going to be meeting with me in Sacramento on the wetland restoration program.
Right.
Yeah. What is the what's the aquifer exemption? Just out of curiosity.
The aquifer exemption has to do with where can you re-inject oil produced from oil field operations, and it's based on the TDS. So in this example, Price Canyon down here, they're proposing to inject in what's called a sub-3,000 aquifer. So the TDS is less than 3,000, so it's viewed as a potential water source. And so what we have to do is we make recommendations to State Board. State Board then gives the okay or not. They have veto power with Dogger. And in what we're looking for is containment to make sure whatever they inject into the ground doesn't bleed over into where there's a defined boundary and it can't leave that boundary.
So what an exemption would mean is that they could inject into a sub 3,000 TDS aquifer, which normally they would not be allowed to do.
If we approve it.
If we approve it. Okay, I thought Price Canyon was ROing all their wastewater and shipping it off to John Deere.
Price Canyon is a little bit unique. It's more water than oil.
Yeah.
So, John, do you want to say anything else?
Yeah. To that point, it's like 95% water, maybe 5% oil in the cut. It's a very unusual field in that it expresses right at the surface. You drive through Price Canyon, you can see that the formation there, the Pismo Formation, actually weeps oil on hot days. So you have this unusual circumstance of oil right near the surface, and correspondingly, the groundwater quality is actually very good, relatively speaking, for an oil field. It is a drinking water aquifer by TDS standards. And so you've got that conflicted use there. It's an oil field, and it's got a relatively low TDS. There are no drinking water wells in the oil field, and that's why the company that operates that field is applying for an aquifer exemption there. But because of the low TDS, it raises that unique circumstance of being a relatively high-quality groundwater that's in the middle of an oil field. And so they're applying for an aquifer exemption right now. It's kind of a two-step process. They apply for the aquifer exemption. It goes through regional board review. It goes through state board review. It goes through Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources review. Then it's pushed to EPA. EPA then reviews it, and EPA has the final say on it. So it's this highly iterative process. Then the oil company has to again apply to literally inject into that. So first there's the aquifer exemption, sort of the designation of this as a receiving thing. Then they actually have to go through and apply for the projects.
Oh, that's all I have, unless you have questions.
On the ILRP surface water activities and claims, on page 5, statement here, staff is developing an implementation strategy to actively identify growers who have failed to enroll in the agricultural order. So this seems to have been an issue going back to the beginning of time, almost, with ag. And just trying to identify those that have failed to enroll.
It's kind of like finding those who don't pay their taxes.
Yeah, I mean, has anything changed since the last time we talked about? When we did the order itself, there was discussion about staff was going to do more to identify and bring these folks into the fold.
Yes, we are engaging in a strategy to identify some of the non-filers. I've spoken with several growers as well as consultants and commodity industry group representatives. And this is really a source of frustration for them, where their members and growers themselves are doing what they can, you know, to comply with requirements, and they feel like they're jumping through a lot of hoops, and yet they know people, perhaps even right next to them, who are not even enrolled in the order. So I spoke with them about this effort, and basically I got positive results. Like, we would very much appreciate this. So we did a quick scan so far. We've done a quick scan in the three major agricultural watersheds, Santa Maria, Salinas, and Pajaro. And in less than a day's time, we came up with about 15,000 acres that are not enrolled. And we think that that's probably just the beginning.
Jessica, can we issue some kind of a subpoena or other command to a non-permit holder to have them give us information? Like, if there's a commodities group, can we request that they give us a list of people? And there's got to be an easier way to get this resolved than anecdotally.
Not that I'm aware of.
We can issue subpoenas, right? But do we have to have an active...
Through enforcement, we can issue subpoenas, yes.
Right. What about, you know, the 13, is it 13267 really is just...
That's for anyone who has discharge or is threatening to discharge.
Right. And you have to know who they are first.
Well, yeah, you have to be, it has to be aimed at those individuals. The commodity group is not the one discharging.
Right. What if we sent a letter to the commodities groups and asked them for a list of their participants or members?
We can do that. Frankly, I think that the commodity groups and technical service providers are very reluctant to sort of, you know, give us this information. They're not going to want to be in a position where they are playing sort of a regulatory role for us. We've recently acquired good parcel data information as well as landowner information and contact information with those parcels, and we're developing a strategy and a protocol for taking that parcel information and then overlaying it with parcel information that we have in the ENOI and GeoTracker, and where we see large areas where it looks like nobody's enrolled, because we can see where there are enrollments through the GeoTracker system, and then it's just a matter of mapping those parcel numbers where people are enrolled and comparing that to sort of a cookie cutter approach, comparing that to where we have enrollments and where we obviously see agricultural activities. It's a bit tedious, Nevertheless, I think that it is, I think the problem is extensive enough that not only does it warrant it, but that we will come up with a list pretty quickly.
So GeoTracker is giving you what information that leads you to identify?
At this point in time, when somebody enrolls their ranch, what they do is they identify that ranch by placing a pin on a map, which is supposed to be on the centroid, like the center of that area. So it's just a dot on a map. However, then what we can do is we can link that dot to the actual enrollment and see what parcel numbers are enrolled with that particular ranch, and then compare it to the parcel numbers or to the parcels around that area. So
that is tedious.
It is tedious.
What about, doesn't the Agricultural Commissioner's Office have information on people that want to use chemicals for farming?
So,
don't they have to get a permit?
Yes, so I'm just telling you one strategy that we're using, that's the parcel data information. But yes, that is another source of information that we plan on using is a commissioner information. Yes.
Every pesticide applicator has to have a permit, number one. A permit to apply, and then has to report to the Ag Commissioner office the type of pesticides application and when they were applied. And then this is then sent to Department of Pest Regulation. So that's a pretty tight program. I mean, there's not a whole lot of unknown, and in fact, they even regulate now the gardeners, you know, where they were applying pesticides for, you know, home use. So that information is available through every single county that we cover.
Are they identifying which parcel they're going to use these chemicals on?
Have you seen that PUR data? Does it actually identify the parcel?
Yes, it identifies like the specific blocks within the parcel.
Okay.
Yeah.
So have you haven't accessed this information yet?
Yes, we have.
You have?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Have you exhausted going through the information?
No, we are just at the beginning phases of developing a protocol for how we can most efficiently do this.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like...
That's why I alluded to in the EO report.
Okay.
that we're developing a strategy so that it's automated as much as possible, and that we can use as much information that we have to make it most efficient, rather than just looking at a map and going through a map.
Do they have APN numbers?
So in the ENOI, the growers are supposed to give a parcel number.
No, I mean to the Ag Commissioner's office. They do?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
APN numbers.
Yes.
I mean,
if I could just follow up really quickly, and Peter Mertens has worked on this issue. We've actually tried to work with the Ag Commissioners directly to try to get our databases to reconcile. So that's another area to increase efficiency. So if we have the databases talking to each other, then maybe we can see where pesticides are being applied without a permit or where there is no enrollment. And so that's another area that we're working at.
And I'll be quite frank here, you know, with all respect to the board, when we start bringing people forward who have not enrolled, and there's going to be a spectrum. There's going to be people who maybe don't even speak English, and, you know, maybe they say they didn't get the word. You know, they didn't know that they had to enroll. There's going to be that. And then there's going to be maybe operators who we know that they should have enrolled because they have enrolled other ranches, and they have terminated, and they've moved on to another ranch. And the question is going to become, what is going to be the palette, you know, for moving forward to give incentive for anybody who's not enrolled to get enrolled? And we're going to, because this is coming.
Well, I hope it comes sooner than later.
It's coming, yeah.
Yeah.
It's coming. So we sent out 60 certified letters a couple weeks ago, and we're getting movement on those. And some people have immediately enrolled. Some people have ignored us, and some people have called and said, I promised to enroll, and as you expect, there's a spectrum of responses.
I just hope that by the time we revisit the ag order, that this is no longer an issue. that staff is going to be able to say, we've gone through all of our possibilities, our databases, this and that, and this is the best that can be done.
Yeah, I completely agree. And as you know, we have 4 staff in my unit, 3 staff that are actually caseworkers, and we have 4,500 ranchers that are currently enrolled.
Yeah.
That's a lot of space for 3 people. And so it's a matter of prioritizing what our efforts should be. I personally think that this is an effort that is worth pursuing. And yes, we can blitz on it for a while and we can come up with a bunch of names, but it is going to be an ongoing effort for it to be effective on a region scale, on a region-wide scale.
Good.
I don't think it's going to permanently, it's going to be something we constantly have to work at.
Yeah.
Kind of like going to the gym. You know, you can't go to the gym once and think you're done. You got to keep going back and keep going back. So we're going to continue to have that issue. But to sort of end on a positive note, what's our rate of compliance, Chris, right now, you estimate?
So the rate of compliance with respect to enrollment, I think you mean, Mr. Harris?
Yes.
So with respect to enrollment, we think in the 90s, but we were basing that information on an estimate of agricultural lands in our region that came from a source that I don't know where it came from, but the source came 10 years back. When you look at more recent information from census data and the number of irrigated acres that we have in this region, we could probably come up with about another 100,000 acres of enrollment.
So yes. That brings it down to about 75%?
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Yeah. Wow.
The ag community, the ones that have been complying, you know, have expressed to us their frustration that, you know, there's this, it's not fair to ones that have been acting in good faith this whole time, and that there are stragglers out there that for whatever reason are not enrolled. And I think, you know, we just need to keep on after this until we do everything we possibly can.
Yeah, okay? I think I completely agree. And of anybody who's a homeowner and has applied for a permit at their house to do something, and they have to jump through the hoops in order to get their permit, and then they see neighbors around them who don't apply for a permit, and they just do whatever they want. It's a real source of frustration, and if you can, you know, magnify that across the region with growers who feel like they're just being regulated not only by us, but so many other agencies, I feel their pain.
Okay, thank you very much.
One follow-up. Thank you, Chris. So I just want to be clear. I heard you toss out the number 4,500 ranchers. Oh, sorry. Look down, look up, you're gone. 4,500 ranchers currently enrolled. I thought we were, the target number was 2,500.
We have like over 4,000 ranchers enrolled currently. I mean, you know, it fluctuates, obviously, because, like I say, in the Central Coast region, agriculture is a very fluid business, as you know. People come and go, and operators come and go.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So 4,500. So do you have any sense at all of how the percentage of actual farmers that are enrolled versus acreage?
I don't. And even the number of ranches is sort of a moving target because, our tiering structure is such that if you are 500 acres or more, you know, then you could potentially tier 3. And, savvy growers have figured out that if they split their ranches up into smaller ranches and more ranches, then they can,
they can. So the last question I have for you is, if I understood correctly, you can see where, because of GeoTracker, you can see where kind of clustered areas where enrollment is occurring. So is there any way we can elevate the idea of these particular regions being more engaged and more in working and advancing the idea of best practices? Is there opportunities to work with the associations and the commissioner's office to help recognize that certain areas are moving forward into these programs, and we should be recognizing, you know, there are certain areas that are that understand the benefit and the value that's coming along with it, and maybe turn that message around to help others see, you know, what is coming. And this is, I'm not surprised, actually, no. Understanding how communities, move into new paradigm. This is a new paradigm. And so there are people that have the ability to do this, and there are people that are more capable of doing it. And as you said, we may see language issues. We may see really low income, very kind of small scale end of the spectrum. And those are the farmers that are probably the most itinerant in terms of moving from parcel to parcel. And so we have to recognize that their challenge is, it may have a few more hurdles in it than the early, what I would refer to as the early adopters, those that can come in to a new scenario, come up with the fees, handle the computer-based, applications, understand what's involved, and then where needed, participate in these broader programs, the monitoring programs and so forth. So we need to keep in mind that these folks, if they're falling through the cracks, now it's time to look again at what is our outreach look like, what does our network look like, who are our partners, because we do need to see different ways of kind of moving through layers of, possibilities for partnering with local community-based or in other ways organizations that touch, these areas that aren't coming forward. So if you see an entire area, to me it says that they're not in the loop. They're out of the loop for some reason. So if we have a geographic pattern going on, there may be some other ways to look at it creatively.
True. That is true. And you pretty much hit the nail on the head. We have, we have a broad spectrum of people or growers who are not enrolling, and some of that includes people who are just going to have a more difficult time enrolling. And as the executive officer's report states, I'm currently in the throes of developing workshops to help reach out to some of these growers, and we're developing those workshops in such a way that there's going to be an afternoon session and a morning session, and one of those sessions is going to be Spanish only, and we know that we're going to be able to fill some of the fill these rooms. When we do a sweep for compliance with update of the annual compliance form, for example, an update of the ENOI, which is supposed to happen October 1st of every year, and we have literally hundreds of people who have not updated the information in the annual compliance form. We send emails, we send letters, and finally we send a notice of violation. And very quickly, what we get is a large proportion of those people who got the notice of violation who were having some sort of a communication problem, or they don't have access to a computer, or they don't read their email like we do. We have handheld devices and so on. And so these problems persist, and so we're working on it through workshops that I'm currently coordinating. And I'm doing it with agencies like Farm Bureau. So, okay, thank you.
Just a couple comments on this. I appreciate the work that you guys are doing, and I recognize it's not as easy as it sounds. The mapping software we're using is pretty powerful, but it's difficult to work with. It's difficult to tell it to do anything that it doesn't already know how to do, and there are all sorts of other wrinkles, like every county using a different APN system with a different number of numbers in each segment. I think that while I concur with Chris that, as he put it delicately, the commodity organizations would be resistant to becoming regulators. We've put a lot of work into kind of slowly building some trust relationship, which is almost certainly going to be put to the test when we start going back to redo the ag waiver. The more capital we start with, the better. We would put organizations like the growership organizations, the different commissions, in a nearly impossible position if we ask them to essentially start turning people in, because that we would absolutely outrage their base at them. I don't think it works. There may be some other ways we can engage them. You know, for example, you know, if we're going to do you know, workshops to help people who have had issues with enrolling or updating information, you know, we can ask those organizations to do outreach to their members, not necessarily to point out their members who are, you know, who are not enrolled, but to do more generic outreach about the workshops, that kind of stuff. You know, I think they'd be more than willing to do that. But I do think we have to be careful about asking people to do stuff that realistically they're not in a position to do.
Reading over the ag order, it says that failure to submit technical reports, et cetera, may subject a discharger to enforcement. If for these late entrants, you know, who come into this program late, is there, what kind of enforcement is there, or what kind of penalties might there be if it's demonstrated that they knowingly avoided the program in order to avoid the costs of being part of it?
If that were to happen, and I think that we will probably have some cases where we can demonstrate that scenario, then the fines could be pretty big. And I think Jessica could probably help me out with this. 13-260, I believe, right? Yeah.
So it would be part of the enforcement team to determine appropriate penalties. However, it could be up to $10,000 a day of discharging without a permit.
Okay, last little nitpicky question to follow on with my first one is, does the failure to file an NOI fall into the category of failing to submit technical reports or their attachments?
It would be failing to obtain a permit.
Okay, thank you.
So, Mr. Delgado, may I can answer as Angela Schroeder, and also remind the board that we've done this. So we have taken ACLs to this board for failure to enroll in the past. I don't know exactly when, maybe Harvey, you can remind me, but we also took separately what we called the expedited payment letters. So we made a fee schedule based upon acreage for growers who had failed to enroll, and took into account acreage and also lateness. And it was a fraction of the maximum penalty. So that was another tool that we've used in the past.
And I might add that I think since then, the enforcement policy has been rewritten, I believe, and the EPLs are now more than they used to be. So it's still going to be a significant amount of money. I mean, it's even the minimum, because we were looking at some minimum penalties, and I think the lowest we could get was $10,000, even on a small infraction.
Well, I understand that the commodity groups don't want to rat on those who aren't participating, but in the fairness sense, it seems like they might be willing to put in their newsletters and their outreach reminders of the enforcement that can follow, and that's not ratting anyone. That's just saying, hey, if you don't join what we're already doing, it's at your loss, and it's best for everyone if you do.
Yes, they can do that. And typically what I do when I engage in an effort such as we're doing right now, coming up with a strategy to try to efficiently sort of ferret out people who have not enrolled, is I let the agencies and the technical service providers know that I'm doing this, so that they can get the word out to their membership. If you know anybody, you know, if you know anybody, beware, because the regional board is looking at this. And I sent that email out, whatever it was, you know, a few weeks ago, and I immediately got a response from one agency saying, I'll let our membership know. I want to let them know, look, you better be aware, because we're trying to find non-enrollees.
Because that could put some out of business. It could send some people to court bankruptcy actions.
Absolutely.
Disrupt their operations, you I bet. Suppose.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Harris?
I'm done.
I have one speaker card, Kay Mercer.
Hello, I'm Kay Mercer with KMI, and thank you, Chairman Young, for being the perfect segue into my presentation. But it did change as I listened to you guys.
Well, you could inform us, you know, as to what else could be done about trying to get the rope around everybody.
A rope. Well, around the neck. So... a couple of things. I just wanted to confirm that growers are very concerned, not just about the enrollment issue, but about a compliance at all stages. And last night, as I listened to the Mid-State Fair from my front porch, I kind of went back through some reports that have taken place in 2014 and 2015 to kind of get a feel for compliance at all different levels. Who's enrolled? Who's, you know, filed their ACF, who has done their nitrate risk determinations. And so I know staff is really busy, and staff has been very helpful with every one of the individual growers I know that has interfaced with them. I know there's a lot on their plate. It would be really helpful, maybe after the October 1 deadline, to get an update on compliance, number of operations, the number of acres, and the percent compliance kind of at each level. That would be really helpful. I have growers that are tier three growers, clients that are tier three growers that are being asked to submit some additional technical reports. And it's really upsetting considering that they know people aren't enrolled, they know people haven't filed their ACFs, they know people haven't done their nitrate risk determinations or their technical applied or their total applied nitrogen reports. They don't agree with the criteria for tier three designations, and now they're being asked to submit reports that are going to make them very vulnerable to public scrutiny. I can tell you they were upset. So my ideas, you asked me for ideas. When I go to the farmers markets, I ask the farmers, what are you doing about water quality? They know nothing about it. So that kind of gives you an idea of who is not aware. I think that staff could do outreach to the farmers markets associations. That might be a good place to start. I also recently was hired by a client to help them be compliant at when they bought a new piece of property that was in annual crop production. Now they're going; it'll be converted to vineyards. The previous owner was an organic grower. He didn't enroll, and he said, I don't have to enroll, I'm organic. I really think there needs to be outreach to the organic community, organic grower community. They do not think they have to enroll. They think, many of them do not. So I think that's two places, and I think this was a robust discussion. A lot of the people that are non-compliant do not have the resources to comply. That's what I do. I help people stay compliant, and I can tell you it's very expensive. Even for the tier one growers, the language issues and just taking the time. If you're a small sustainable grower, small organic grower, a direct to market grower, you don't have those resources to take the time to fill out the forms. And one of the things I'm really running into is trying to keep the, for tier two and tier three growers, trying to keep the forms compliant. So they have a farm water quality plan, And then all the other forms that are submitted, if they do something in the field, they have to change the farm water quality plan. Now it's not consistent with their all the stuff that they've reported. So at what point, so if they get an inspection, I've been on inspections, and I thought the inspections were well conducted, but the truth is, when the inspectors came out, they knew exactly what they wanted to look at. So they had reviewed all the compliance forms and the file, and they wanted to look at this, 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 and this. Well, if a grower has changed his farm water quality plan, then, and it's not consistent, you know, that is the inspector going to make a big deal out of that? I mean, at what point in time does this all have to be consistent? And we're really struggling with this right now, because quite honestly, tier two and tier three growers submit a lot of information, and some of it is a subset of the farm water quality plan. So how do you keep it consistent? So any outreach is very difficult. The issue of asking the trade associations, you have to understand too, or you don't have to understand it, but you might want to, that the a lot of these growers, these small growers, can't afford the fees to belong to the trade associations. So going to the trade associations is not going to access these small growers. It's just not. The trade associations, Mr. Delgado, the trade associations do outreach continuously on all issues, not just water issues, but on the water issues. I have to pay fees to belong to these trade associations in order to know what kind of communication they're sending to my clients, so I know what they're sending out. So that is all going out to the trade. Any other questions?
I really appreciate hearing from you, Kay, because I know that you are on the ground and you have worked in various capacities, you know, so you've seen a lot of iterations. And so I'm heartened by, you know, your realistic sense of, you know, how people are complying and then where the wrinkles in the process actually are unfolding, because that is the very thing that we entered into this, at least I did, entered into this current permit with that idea, that understanding that we would find out what actually is involved with being in compliance. So those are all important observations that you bring to us. So I appreciate your time when you come to these meetings to help us stay informed and stay kind of on that leading edge of, you know, what solutions are the growers coming up with, because I know they work collectively to help each other, but in other ways they can't be that collaborative, and so there are limits to that collaboration.
When it comes to the small growers, I've found that the RCDs are very active in that area, particularly as we move to the northern part of the region. Santa Cruz RCD, Monterey, Monterey has a lot of growers. I mean, the grower demographics get smaller as you move out from Monterey, the grower demographics are larger. As you move to SLO, Santa Barbara, Santa Clara, San Benito, and Santa Cruz, they get much smaller. The further away you get from Monterey, the smaller the growers get. So that tells you where, if you want to engage the small grower community, it tells you where you need to put your efforts.
Yeah, I agree, although there's another constraint with the RCDs. I mean,
oh, yeah.
They don't want to get into the middle of enforcement or tracking.
Regulatory issues.
And if we lose them in their technical assistance capacity, that would be a huge step backward. So we don't want to do that either.
They can't, you know, no one's going to be able to give you the list, right? That's just not going to happen.
Right.
Or I don't think it'll happen. But they can help you do the outreach. And then once you identify these people, they can, you know, there needs to be resources to assist them, because they simply cannot do it on their own. Particularly if they're a tier two grower. You know, if they're a tier one grower, they fill out the farm plan, put it on a shelf. I mean, let's be honest, they'll fill out the farm plan, put it on the shelf. Mm-hmm. But if they're a tier two grower, they're really going to struggle.
Well, thank you.
So, Kay, you identified two areas here. One is there are people that are failing to submit reports, so they're obviously enrolled. And that's something staff should be able to pick up on in due time. The other group is the organic small farmers that you've alluded to. Do you think that's the crux of what's remaining?
I don't know. Okay. I mean, I hear stuff, but I don't know.
Right.
I have no idea. You're asking me, are there larger growers? Are there vegetable growers?
Well,
I just don't know. I okay. do not know the answer to that.
Because staff seems to think there might be 100,000 acres that have not enrolled yet.
The difficult thing with trying to determine acres, you can use some of the big data sources that show geographical distribution, but there's difficulties with that because of of different kinds of rotation. If you go to the Ag Commissioner's reports, their crop acres are harvested crop acres, which means if you have a piece of land, an acre, and it's harvested twice, you have 2 acres, right? And so then how do you get to the real acres? And so that, I know when in the 2004 waiver, that was one of the difficulties we had with trying to figure out how many acres there are. You think it would be easy, but it's really not that easy. I mean, staff's got a huge task ahead of them.
Okay, thank you.
You know, I've been listening to, everyone, and I think, firstly, to address the issue of agriculture organizations, if a request is going to be made to agriculture organizations to remind everyone of a need for compliance, I think there's needs for more specifics, because just to throw out there, say, hey, reminder, you need to comply. I think it's in a vacuum. So I heard the input about the difficulty of getting our hands around how many acres and possibly how many ranches are not currently enrolled or in compliance, but I think there is a need to be able to be a little bit more specific to show, okay, we know enough information that this is the lack of compliance. So I think there's a little hole there. I'm not very comfortable just to raise a red flag and lack quantitative information. The second part is that, yes, I think there are areas where the outreach can be increased and be effective. Utilizing, for example, VRCDs, and full disclosure, I'm vice president of the Coastal San Luis RCD. Every RCD has websites. So you can take all the RCDs within the Central Coast, and I'm absolutely sure that the RCDs would say, yeah, we would put an article just in terms of a reminder of cooperation. And I see, you're shaking your head, but the fact is that growers are using the RCDs, for example, for the mobile irrigation labs. Okay, that's a very successful program that's being done, and that's part of Tier 2, Tier 3, and also the SIP program. So RCDs would be one source. Farm Bureau is another source also that can be used. They have a broad base of memberships. And what I'm referring to here is basically little articles of reminders that for example, RCDs can help people who need compliance in terms of their nutrient management programs and the use of a mobile irrigation lab. And some of these are grant-based, by the way. So, there is assistance available. In terms of the use of information from other agencies, this is getting back to what we talked about earlier, is Department of Pest Regulation, has a fair amount of information regarding, who has permits to spray. And I think maybe we have an issue of being able to utilize softwares And I'm not clear on that, you know, and I'm not too sure of the ability of using our software that tracks, you know, properties, ranches, et cetera, and how these software can be used to make comparison with software, say, that DPR has. I don't have the answer to that, but, you know, I think that's something that's eventually going to have to be worked on, because trying to do this piecemeal, it's not going to work. You know, there's just too many properties. And then the last comment I'm going to make, it's a moving target. So you're never, I think, going to get 100% compliance. If you want that, I think, you know, that's an overdose of optimism, because the nature of the business, you have a lot of what I'll call transient activity, where you have management companies will go in one property, they'll manage that, then it moves to another one, the names change. Yes, the property remains, but it's a moving target, I guess that's my point. So if we're saying, if you were telling me you're 98% compliant, I'd say that's pretty darn good, and then you have diminishing results of trying to get to 99.9. It's going to take disproportionate amount of effort. Now, if you're saying we're 70% compliant in terms of, you know, your estimate, that's a different story. And I just don't have a feel right now. You know, I'm hearing this 100,000 acre. I'm like, whoa, where is that coming from? That was kind of a surprise to me. So I guess my concluding remark is that I'm a little bit in a... somewhat at a loss of, you know, I thought we were a lot closer to compliance, and maybe I'm misunderstanding, but that's where I feel. Go ahead.
So if I could make a suggestion, I think because we're not immediately going to redo the ag order, after the annual re-up of growers in October and some other reporting that has to be done by them, that we can come back to you early next year after staff has a chance to process the data and come back and give you some real accurate numbers in terms of where we are in terms of compliance and what they're doing, and we'll make a agendized item out of it and give you a comprehensive discussion of the program. I do want to jump ahead a little bit. I'm not opening the next item, but I want to just make you aware of, you know, in the item 21, there was a listing of programs and staffing needs. And because this is a current discussion item in Sacramento, on the irrigated lands, for example, we have 7.5 staff working on that program. 5.3 of those staff are borrowed from other programs. We're only funded at 2.2 staff for the entire ag program. So. And then if you look at what staff has determined we think we need, we actually, if we were to replace those people and let them go back to their other programs where they're funded from and add the three that we need, we'd have to add 8.3 new staff just for the ag program to bring it up to a level that we've determined we need to adequately run the program. So we're already behind the eight ball just in terms of trying to do what we do now, let alone take on new initiatives. So it's a big challenge for us to do much more. And I can tell you that the staff, they work very, very hard all the staff do, but the ag staff work very, very hard and have done some great work even with this deficit. So you know, hopefully deficit, maybe something will happen to help correct that, but right now we're doing everything we can with the staff that we have working on the program.
Okay. Dr. Wolf, I would like staff as part of this October...
Early next year,
whenever staff comes back to us with the enrollment numbers, I would like staff to at least show the board what kind of information the Ag Commissioner's Office has. I don't need all the information. I'd like to see kind of a an example of, if they have a list of whatever, people that apply for pesticide usage, just to look at the format that it's coming in. Then the other thing would be with the same office, do farmers report how much they harvest for a given crop? Is that something that is reported?
I don't know. Okay. I walked up here to say that. The Ag Commissioners report yields. They'll report like the bushels and that sort of thing.
Right, right.
But I don't know where they get that information.
So maybe staff.
Maybe, do you know, Jean-Pierre?
Yeah, I can answer that. The Ag Commissioner does an annual survey, and the survey ultimate goal is to come up with the total crop value, you know, X amount of millions of dollars. To do that, they ask, and this is voluntarily done, to report how many acres and how many tons of particular ag commodity has been produced. And that's how, for example, this year the report shows that last year the strawberry growers were the last largest ag commodity. So that's basically not in as much to pin down how many acres, but it's to identify crop value, and then it's combined so that each county can say, hey, our total crop commodities are, you know, 750 million or whatever.
But I don't know how much tie-in there is between, like, the crop reports and the DPR reports.
Okay.
I think they may be two separate databases.
Can you say that again, the crop report?
I don't know how much connection or connectivity there is between the crop reports and the DPR pesticide use reports.
They're apple and oranges.
Yeah, I don't know how much crossover you'll get.
But I'm just thinking of them as just two separate sources of information that can be looked at, that's all. And I like using government information.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I know the trade groups are gonna be very reluctant to share information. I'm not naive about that, okay? But I do think where growers have to comply with a regulation to report something that relates back to farming, irrigated farming, that we should try to go after those sources of information. So pesticide use is the only one I'm aware of. What about using fertilizer? They don't have to get a permit for that, or?
No.
Okay.
No, but, you know, and anyone including, as a reminder, organic farmers, because often people think, oh, organic farmers don't use pesticides. No, they do.
Right.
If you use canola oil and you use soap, that's technically a pesticide, and it is regulated, and you have to get a permit even for organic application. So the most precise information is from the pesticide application reports that goes to the Ag Commissioner.
So I just do want to say that, you know, ag is not encouraging enforcement, but they would like more equity in compliance. So, I mean, so, you know, it's not like all these growers are saying, go out there and enforce on these other growers. That is certainly not the message I'm trying to convey, but that there needs to be some equity and some fairness in who, you know.
And that's my only goal is just to get them enrolled.
Yeah, good.
Enforcement's a secondary thing for me at this point.
And complying with the other aspects, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
I have a question.
So,
I can wait.
No.
I detect discomfort on the board's level because it's kind of a surprise that there might be upwards of 100,000 acres. And I refer to page 5 of our item number 20, just below where Jeff referred earlier about prevalent non-enrollment, basically. And it says, particularly in a few specific areas, and one area or two areas were recently mentioned by Kay were organic farmers and farmers market growers. But also Chris mentioned a specific area that you already looked at where there's 15,000 acres. So when you say particularly in a few specific areas, do you mean geographically you've mapped some areas, or do you mean big growers or small growers?
I mean geographic areas. I mean geographic areas. So we could take a look, again, we could take a look at the ENOI database and what enrollees we have, and we can see large areas where there doesn't appear to be any enrollment. Then we have also other information, such as the census data that I was talking about earlier. And I'll just say it, that indicates that Santa Cruz area is an area that we have a lower proportion of enrollment in the Santa Cruz County area.
Okay, and that would be a lot of smaller farmers.
Probably.
So in your overall 20,000 foot level view, do you think there's a mix of large growers who know better and small growers who may or may not know better? Or do you think it's mostly small growers?
I think it's a mix.
Okay.
I do think it's a mix. Anecdotally, whenever we get a rain event, I probably get at least a half a dozen calls of complaints, probably maybe more like 10 for each rain event. And for every complaint that I get, half of them involve somebody who is not enrolled. And in some cases, they could be a strawberry grower. It could be a lettuce grower. It could be somebody who's on an orchard. And so it really varies. Just in the analysis that we did where we came up with the 15 acres in about a day or two, again, the spectrum is really quite wide. We have everybody from growing grapes to growing vegetables. And it could be a 100-acre block. It could be not a block, but a 100-acre ranch. It could be even more than that.
Okay.
So it's a pretty big spectrum.
And Chris, my last question, I noticed in the ag order that the executive officer can require a report of waste discharge if someone hasn't enrolled, and they should. How onerous is a report of waste discharge? What's involved with that?
So we could do that. You know, if they didn't enroll, or if the situation warranted that we wanted to issue them an individual WDR, we could do that.
But what is a report on waste discharge?
Jessica?
So, like yesterday, the landfill permit, that was a WDR. That's so a report of waste discharge. They're all kind of
synonymous.
Yeah.
Okay.
We use the term under Port of Cologne for report of waste discharge to mean WDRs or NPDES permits. These would be WDRs because they're only waters of the state. And NPDES really doesn't affect ag. So they would be WDRs, and they're much different than just enrolling in a permit where they can, you know, fill out the ENOI and comply. There's a lot more involvement with staff. CEQA can be triggered.
Okay. Thank you.
A significant workload to do an individual WDR, and that's why we're going to general permits to streamline the process and reduce the workload, because the water boards cannot handle the tens of thousands of permits on an individual basis.
Yeah, I was just thrown by that term, report on waste discharge, which is in the order.
It's in the water code, yeah.
Thank you.
And just one final note regarding enforcement for non-enrollees, if we decided to go that route for certain situations. Each one of those cases have to be handled individually. We can't come to you with a batch and say, let's talk about these as a batch. Instead, each one of them are individual and require individual staff work. It's a lot of work.
Well, Chris, wouldn't it be kind of like the IRS audits? I mean, they might have some randomness to who they audit, but you know that you're subject to an unannounced audit. And if there were a few audits of individual cases in our realm done, I think that's kind of how the world works in some of these cases, right?
Yeah, indeed. So we can do randomized audits, and if you're talking about non-enrollment, to try to figure out who these people are who have not enrolled. So we can do randomized audits, but then what we can also do is we can use, again, the information that we have from DPR, census data, and so on, to get a larger acreage with less effort, you know. So,
A current example of report of waste discharge, and I know that myself and Dr. Wolf got a email from Steve Schimmick this week telling us that just finalizing the fact that Coast Keeper had won the lawsuit against Monterey County Water Resource Agency dealing with the Blanco Drain and the rec ditch, where the court has now ordered Monterey County to submit a report of waste discharge for their activities related to those two water bodies within 30 days. So it's significant in that, you know, it was a court case to force somebody to submit a report of waste discharge. So it can get pretty involved.
Can I just one more thing? Mr. Johnson mentioned the APN issue a little bit earlier, and that is a real issue for us. On the ENOI, the grower has to put down the parcel numbers that are enrolled in those ranches. And a lot of growers, I think they just don't understand what the parcel number is. Maybe they have their tax bill and they see so many numbers on there. And what we get on the ENOI is it's all over the map. And yet, in some cases, they may not want to divulge their information, yet at the same time, it's that very information that we need to give them credit for enrollment. So we're working on ways to force the correct format into the reporting forms so that if you're in Santa Barbara County and you have a certain number of digits that are in your APN, or if you're Monterey and you have a certain number of digits that are in your APN, maybe with hyphens and so forth, that's forced, that when the grower inputs that they have to use the right number to give us the tools we need that would make our life a lot easier to find the non-enrollees.
I had one comment, but now I have two. So relative to that APN number, there's a perfect singular message that goes out to every organization, every association. You know, do you know what your APN number is, really? Because if you're filing, you know, any of these following reports, or if you are, you know, part of any of these programs and the APN is required, this is what it looks like. I mean, that would be, I think, something very helpful, because we do want people to get the credit and to be properly listed for the work that they are doing to stay in compliance, and yet you don't have that key element. So that would be a great article, one or two paragraphs that says, you know, it's confusing, mm-hmm. but here's what it looks like. You know, and we would like to help you get the right number, you
agreed.
Know, on your
yeah.
form.
Agreed, yeah. And we can include that in our outreach efforts.
Yeah, in your workshops.
Yeah,
yeah.
You bet. Absolutely.
Let's
yeah.
look at those.
Yes.
Well, I wanted to circle back around to what Mr. Young was talking about, understanding what the government information is that we might be able to utilize to make some headway with identifying potential, you know, enrollees. So my thought is, I'm drawing back to the work we did on the governor's Safe Drinking Water Stakeholder Group, and I was on the data committee, and one of the things, and just as you were speaking right now, you listed about three different sources that are available: census data, pesticide control, and possibly Ag Commissioner data set. So to me, it would be very helpful, and this is the approach we took, because everybody had different ideas about what's the existing and available data and what does it look like. And so we did just a matrix, and it was very simple to just create the columns. Who's got the data? What kind of data it is? Is it hard copy data? Is it digital data? And then maybe give a few examples of what are the, or give a short description of the key nexus between what we need and what they might have. And that might help us to see possibilities for where the efficiencies are, and so low-hanging fruit versus, you know, things that are more complicated to accomplish. And even if you were to move small percentages forward, you know, through kind of looking at low-hanging fruit, and it sounds like that's what you're in the process of doing. So it would just be a different way maybe of summarizing the information for us to be able to help think through and maybe brainstorm, you know, what possibilities we could leap forward with.
Sure. Yeah, I appreciate that comment. And the staff person who is assigned with this effort, the first part of the assignment is to deliver to me a strategy for how we're going to go about doing this in the most efficient way. before we even launch. We're just not going to fly by the seat of our pants. We have to have a strategy to try to, again, you know, this make this as least tedious and most effective as possible, and use as much data and information we have, like from government agencies and so on. So.
And you know, not to beat a dead piece of lettuce, but there are other mechanisms, but I'm not sure how practical it would be to get the cooperation of other agencies. I'll give you an example. You know, grape growers have to submit to the California Department of Food and Agriculture every year a very detailed report of every ton of fruit, you know, who it is sold to, what's the BRIX, what's the variety, and also acreage information. So every year, what you receive is a acreage report by county, very detailed, with what kind of varieties are grown, and when they were planted, et cetera. What is in production, what is not yet in production. And then you receive also a report that gives you market pricing of all the different commodities. That same information that you submit is used for the Pierce disease tax assessment. Okay, so that's available for California. The growers also, not just grape growers, have to submit every year a USDA report. I showed Ken one day a sample of it. It's very, very detailed about how many acres of what do you grow, do you lease it from somebody else, what's on it, what's your cost of production. That information is used, and it's, by the way, mandatory. It's subject to penalty if you do not submit that report. And that information going to USDA is used for the Farm Bill purposes. What we're looking for is basically available there. However, I'm not sure the mechanics of being able to get cooperation of USDA. They may say, no, you know, we don't want to share that information, but it's there. I painfully fill out this form, and I can assure you that that report takes a heck of a lot of time compared to some other regulatory reports that we have to fill out. And I showed it to Mr. Harris when I was ready to fill it out. So there may be some other, I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, out of the box ideas, but we may be able to use government data. You know, I think that's a good point. And that way it keeps the trade organizations, you know, from being put into a precarious position. So anyway, I just want to wrap up.
Yes, thank you. We will really investigate all those options you mentioned, yeah, and more.
See, I was just going to suggest we've spent a lot of time on this. I know you're interested in it. We will come back next year with a scheduled item and allow plenty of time for discussion. So I would request that if the board, we could wrap this up and maybe take a 10-minute break and then come back and work on strategic planning.
And this, the answer I'm looking for is probably that we would recover this during the item 22, or the strategic 21. Your Prop 1 table that appears on page 5, four of those funds are coming up with guidelines in 2015, and so I would be really interested to know if any of our communities are already preparing or tracking on this, or what kind of outreach, or where these monies might be directed within our region. And if that's something that is part of the discussion for item 21, that would be great.
Do you want to answer now?
Well, if you're telling me that we're talking about in 21, that would be great.
Katie's here, but so the Katie McNeil, who does is very, very active in
yes,
that. And as I said yesterday, we've redone our website. I'm about to send a letter out to all the parties. We are looking, trying to match wherever we can communities with funding. But they, and in fact, the as you know, depending on the topic, there is an Office of Sustainable Water now, something like that, that actually will provide assistance and grants to communities, like using RCRC to help some of the more disadvantaged communities actually do the application. So there's a lot going on. I get all the LIRIS feeds from that. So we're engaged to the extent we can be at this point, I think.
So I guess the logic for me is to, when we look at strategies for these programs, if there's any nexus with these new funds coming out of Prop 1, or even out of any of the other funding streams that are being directed to issues that, you know, fall into our camp. So hoping that that's part of the plan for this afternoon.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, let's take a break.
Say 10 minutes or something?
10 minutes.
Okay.
Back to 5 to 11.